Welcome to The Checkup, brought to you by Medcast, your go-to source for practical insights, clinical updates, and real conversations that matter to healthcare professionals. Whether you're on the go or taking a break, we're here to keep you informed, connected, and inspired.
Hi, and thank you for joining us. My name is Dr. Rebecca Chan. I'm a GP and medical educator with Medcast, and I'll be your host for this podcast series exploring recent clinical updates in women's health. I'm recording today from the land of the Wangal people of the Eora Nation. On today's podcast, we'll be exploring how GPs can safely manage commonly used medications in patients who are planning pregnancy or already pregnant. I'm delighted today to welcome Associate Professor Deborah Kennedy to our podcast. She's the founder and director of MotherSafe, the New South Wales statewide medications in pregnancy and lactation advisory service. Trained in pediatrics and clinical genetics, she's committed to providing evidence-based preconception and prenatal counselling and has been involved in research in the areas of clinical genetics and teratology for over 25 years. Deborah is speaking to us today from the lands of the Bidjigal and Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. So welcome, Deborah. Can we start with today? We are seeing many younger patients on long-term medications, and this can raise important questions once they start thinking about planning a pregnancy. So to help GPs navigate these decisions, can you give us an idea of how you might start this conversation with a patient and what things you might consider?
Sure. So, I mean, I think the really important thing that you said was people planning pregnancy, because that's the ideal time to be having these conversations and having a good discussion about what medications are really needed to treat significant conditions, what could be potentially stopped or switched to something that might have a better safety profile in pregnancy. It's always much more difficult when someone is already pregnant and they're on a medication that you would rather they wouldn't have been on, because then that's obviously more difficult conversation to have. So planning is really important. And we always talk, when I first see anyone, whether they're planning or actually pregnant, we talk about, well, there are always risks. No pregnancy comes with a guarantee. So it's always really balancing up the risks of whatever medication somebody's on, but recognizing that even not taking a medication, there's a small chance, 2 or 3% of having a baby with a major birth defect. And then weighing that, well, what are the risks of a particular condition and untreated, whether it's a medical condition or psychiatric condition in the mother, the risks to her health, to the pregnancy and to the baby, and really balancing all that.
So if we were going to look at some specific medications, particularly ones that I think are common among younger patients, for example, the one that comes to mind, the SSRIs or the SNRIs as well, where's the current advice on that at the moment in terms of if a patient came to you before they were pregnant, discussing whether they should or shouldn't continue on the medication?
So firstly, I suppose you'd get an idea of what she's being treated for. Is it a long-standing anxiety or depression? Has she had a significant history where she's ended up hospitalised for a major major depressive episode? Because we know that, you know, pregnancy is not going to cure significant depression. There are some women who've been, you know, through a bad time who don't want to come off their medications because they know what it's like. Other women are really anxious about being on medication, and then it's weighing up, well, are they going to be more anxious being on it or not being on it? It's also really important, I suppose, that I always talk about, well, it's a holistic approach. So it's not just medication. It's important that women see whether it's their GP or a psychologist or have that ongoing psychosocial support as well. So you're not just totally relying on medication. But in terms of medication, if you've kind of made that decision or that the woman is keen to continue her medication because she knows that she's better on it, then we talk about the fact that I suppose we divide pregnancy into different stages. So in terms of in terms of the embryonic period, so if you like, in terms of birth defects, we say that there's no evidence to suggest that any of the SSRIs or SNRIs are associated with a significantly increased risk of birth defects and major structural defects, which happen in that first embryonic period. We know that there's also no evidence to say that they're significantly associated with a higher chance of miscarriage or with fertility problems. So that's that sort of early part. The next stage is, well, is this medication more likely to if it's acting on my brain and nervous system, what's it doing to the baby's brain and nervous system? And again, the data that we've got that is available does not suggest that these medications are associated with higher chances of children having intellectual difficulties, cognitive problems, behavioral problems, or autism. So overall, we'd say, look, there's not compelling evidence that there are adverse sort of neurodevelopmental outcomes. There's also some evidence to say that the children of mothers with severe depression that are untreated actually do worse than children of mothers who are well treated. And we know that if a woman has got a significant major depression and are untreated or undertreated, may not seek advice, may not have good antenatal care, or might self-medicate with alcohol and other substances that might actually be more harmful than a prescribed dose of an antidepressant. So that's really important to sort of, I suppose, factor into that discussion. Then the last thing we talk about is, well, if a woman uses a medication throughout pregnancy, once baby's born, baby needs to adapt to life ex utero. And we always warn women that there is a small chance that babies may have neonatal adaptation problems. And it's not always clear if it's a prolonged effect of the medication or if it's a withdrawal. SSRIs like fluoxetine have a long half-life, so it's more likely that it's a prolonged effect of the medication, whereas paroxetine and venlafaxine have shorter half-lives, so it's possibly a withdrawal. I suppose how I counsel people is that that's not a deal breaker. It's not a reason not to take the medication, and it's certainly not a reason to reduce the dose of the medication. So we warn people to, be aware that it can happen. The vast majority of babies don't have a significant adaptation issues, but we say, look, probably make sure that, baby can be observed and make sure, feeds are established before probably going home. And I generally would recommend women taking several psychotropics for certain shouldn't have a home delivery just so that they can be observed. But that's, again, that's not categorical.
Yeah, so it's a much more holistic view of that whole maternal mental health than just the medication itself, isn't
Absolutely.
it? Yeah. You did mention a couple of specific types of medications. I mean, I don't know if there is or isn't, but is there any data that shows one is particularly safer than another, or in general, would you sort of not really worry about which one they're on?
Look, I think there's a sort of perception that sertraline is safer. There's certainly, in terms of breastfeeding, it's probably the one that's least detectable in milk. Having said that, if someone's been well and stable on fluoxetine, we certainly wouldn't be recommending switching from one to the other, because we know that, I mean, you're taking it for a reason, and sometimes one is going to work better than the other. So generally, we're not going to advocate switching from one SSRI antidepressant to the other on purely fetal safety grounds. Unfortunately, paroxetine, all of them are category C. And the reason they're category C is because it's not around birth defects, around sort of those adaptation problems and the withdrawal. The problem is that paroxetine, for reasons that were sort of probably not based on fabulous research, was recategorized as D because there was a supposedly increased risk of heart defects, which really didn't necessarily pan out particularly. And I suppose, again, putting it in context, if you say that between 1 in 100 and 1 in 200 babies are going to be born with a heart defect in the general population. So if you believe the studies that say the worst, is that there's a doubling of that background risk, there's still only sort of 1 to 2% chance of having a baby with a heart defect, even if you believe that paroxetine doubles that risk. So it's still, the absolute risk is still low. And so I think that's a really important to emphasize. And again, I see women who've been told you should get off paroxetine, but it's actually the best drug for them. And we say, well, look, on balance, then that's, you're taking it for a reason. If that's a drug that works best for you, see how you go.
I guess perhaps a consideration if there was a discussion about the need to initiate medication for whatever reason during the pregnancy, perhaps we would avoid paroxetine in that instance.
Yeah, I think so. And I think escitalopram and sertraline are the ones that probably overall have been shown to have the lowest risks overall, but really it's much of a muchness. So we'd say, look, if someone is well and established, certainly on one of the other ones, we certainly wouldn't recommend changing. But I think, yes, if you're initiating it, and also around breastfeeding, because sertraline is probably the one that's got the least detectable drug in the milk. So that's something that people, find appealing, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess it's really just weighing up you know, all of those points that you discussed and looking at it in a much more holistic way than the medication itself when it comes to making those decisions. And you're probably making them together as well.
Exactly. People worry about postnatal depression, which is obviously a thing, but one of the biggest predictors of postnatal depression is poorly managed anxiety and depression during pregnancy. So if it's not well managed through, then, you know, it's not going to suddenly miraculously get better once you've got a baby. So, and that's the problem as well, that I think people underestimate that. And certainly people with major, like psychotic, like bipolar disorder, I mean, there's a tendency for women to be told, oh, you should come off your medications. And then there's a significant risk of relapse with women off medication. And that, you know, can be really serious.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess sort of touching on that, some of those cases where women are on medications that do have much more significant considerations for their health. So, for example, maybe those mood stabilizers or some of the anti-epileptics, for example. And how do you give guidance around that's where the need to stay on the medication perhaps has more of a medical indication?
So definitely. So we know that there's a really high chance of relapse, of recurrence with, you know, true bipolar. And I mean, I think lithium's a great mood stabilizer. The bad press, you know, from the 70s, and that was also partly ascertainment, but yeah, that was associated, thought to be associated with a really high risk of having babies with major birth defects. Prospective studies have said, look, there probably is a slightly higher risk, but it's probably around 1% or 2% for cardiac defects, not, you know, 30 to 50%, which is what the older data said. And you know, if it's well tolerated, it's a really effective mood stabilizer. And, you know, we see women who are told to come off it because people say, oh, you shouldn't be on lithium when you're pregnant, you know, end up, you know, psychotic. So lithium needs to be managed, you know, it needs, dose needs to be changed, you know, things need to be monitored during pregnancy. But, and some women, if they're well enough, might think about not being on it for the first 10 weeks because that's when the heart's developing. But again, you know, that needs a bit of tweaking as well. Lamotrigine, which is a sort of anti-epileptic drug, a mood stabilizer, has got quite a good data and safety profile in pregnancy. It's not associated with significantly increased risks of birth defects. And if so, it's probably with bigger doses, like over 300 milligrams a day. If people are on lamotrigine, they should take a higher dose of folate when they're trying to get pregnant for the first 3 months. The big no-no is valproate, because valproate is associated with higher risks of not only birth defects but also neurodevelopmental sequelae. And really the data and the recommendations are now pretty clear that absolutely valproate should not be used as a mood stabilizer in pregnancy. If it's the only drug that's going to treat juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, different situation. But even then, you know, hopefully they can be on a better anti-epileptic because it's really not a good one for pregnancy.
Sounds like it's not a one-size-fits-all. There's a lot of considerations to take into account when you're thinking about some of those things, and the maternal factors are definitely a really important factor to be discussing with your patients as well. I guess another condition that is increasingly diagnosed in adults of reproductive age is ADHD, particularly, I think, women who probably feel like they were maybe undiagnosed or not diagnosed at a younger age, and I find they're increasingly getting that diagnosis now. What do we as GPs need to consider, I guess, when counselling patients before they get pregnant or with the lag in and sometimes getting the assessment? I do have patients who get the diagnosis just when, you know, in early pregnancy or something, and then there's a discussion about medications. What's the advice around this?
I think it's tricky because I think, to be perfectly honest, there are a lot of people that have been given the diagnosis that probably don't need to be having their medications when they're pregnant. There are some people that absolutely find that they just don't function without. So I think there's a whole spectrum of, you know, how much do you really need this medication? In terms of safety, there's actually quite a lot of data now around dexamphetamine. It's, you know, been around for a long time. The older data was kind of dirty data because it was data from people using illicit amphetamines, and obviously that they weren't pure exposures, and you know, people were using lots of other things, and that did suggest higher rates of heart defects. But there's sort of the medically prescribed dexamphetamine, there's not been evidence to suggest significantly increased risks of birth defects or other adverse outcomes. Having said that, you know, it's yet another psychotropic that's sort of added to the mix, and there've been sort of theoretical concerns about, you know, could it possibly interfere with fetal growth? Although I think that's theoretical more than real. The advantage of dexamphetamine, so the 5 milligrams, is that people can titrate it. So again, yep, more easily sort of lower, higher doses. And a lot of women maybe don't use it over weekends. And for breastfeeding, again, dexamphetamine, there's some fairly good data, actually Australian data around breastfeeding and it being quite reassuring. There's sort of reasonable data around methylphenidate. I think pregnancy is a good time, or planning is a good time, to really reevaluate what people are on and, you know, do you really need them? Does it really make that much difference? Or, you know, is it a little bit discretionary at this point in your life and can you manage without it? Because in general, we're going to say less is best if you can. Yep. I mean, you know, within reason. And again, it's how do you function? And if it's do, you know, and if you're absolutely not coping, then, well, then it's better that you manage.
Yeah. So again, it sounds like it's just weighing up that impact the medication has on the patient's functioning and whether they, you know, they feel like they need it or they can perhaps manage without it. But it sounds like it's not a definite no from a stimulant point of view.
No.
We're going to change tack slightly and take us away from some of these types of medications and look down at our GLP-1 agonists, you know, Mounjaro, Wegovy, because I think they're also quite commonly prescribed now. Where do these ones sit?
So it's just interesting. We've just had this, I just looked at our numbers and we've just had this massive rise in calls to MotherSafe about this drug.
I'm not surprised.
Not surprising. So again, and the data, look, there's not actually that much data. There's some sort of a handful of published case reports, which are overall reassuring. The issue is, I mean, the animal study suggested slightly higher rates of defects, but that was related probably to maternal toxicity and the fact that mothers weren't eating properly, which is obviously what these drugs do. So we've been reassuring, but obviously the advice, again, people planning pregnancy, depending on the half-life, we say, look, basically most of them have a half-life of about a week or so, you know, 5 to 7 days. So we say, look, after 5 half-lives, the drug's out of your system. So pretty much we say, look, 1 to 2 months, be off it and then try. But as I said, that doesn't always happen.
Yep. And if they are, as you said, if there's that inadvertent exposure that they get pregnant and they're on it, you would just be advising to stop, but fairly reassuring.
We'd be reassuring, but yeah, we would advise that they stop once they realise they're pregnant.
Yep, fair enough. And I guess we've spoken mostly about that preconception planning and that sort of thing, but I guess to touch on those pregnant patients who do have some of the other inadvertent exposures, and so the two, I guess, that I'm thinking of that patients are not uncommonly on is Roaccutane and Doxycycline, you know, for acne. If a patient found out they were pregnant on those medications, is there any advice or recommendations?
Unfortunately, we see a number of women who do get pregnant on Roaccutane, and I think that's a problem. You know, we get probably 10 or 20 calls a year on women get pregnant on Roaccutane.
Yeah.
We can't be reassuring, particularly, I mean, we can be reassuring if they stopped it probably before their period, you know, the missed period.
Yeah.
But, you know, you certainly into the first trimester, it's associated with higher chance of miscarriage, but also significant birth defects. So we can't be reassuring about Roaccutane if women use it once they're into the pregnancy. Topical retinoids, we would be, because the amount absorbed is minimal. So that's not a huge problem. The women who, the Roaccutane exposures, we see them, we do face-to-face or telehealth appointments, and we would always get them to have a scan to make sure that their dates, because often the dates are incorrect. So oftentimes we get these sort of panicked phone calls that, you know, someone's been exposed to Roaccutane and is pregnant. And then when they actually have a dating scan, they actually stopped, you know, just before conception. So then we'd be reassuring. So doing a scan is obviously really helpful. Doing, obviously, beta-HCG bloods are less helpful because it's, you know, much wider ranges. So really doing a dating scan, and we would insist on, if we're going to see someone in clinic, that they've had a scan.
Yeah. And I guess for our interstate listeners as well, is there a similar service in other states that GPs could refer their patients to?
GPs, there are different services in different states. Most of them, so MotherSafe's kind of different because MotherSafe is sort of like a teratogen information service like where we take calls from both consumers and healthcare providers. Some of the different states do have sort of medicines information services through the obstetric, the maternity hospitals. they varyingly take calls from consumers or not, but certainly their healthcare providers can get that information and then speak to the patients about it.
Yeah. And just quickly before we wrap up, I just wanted to touch on one more common question that I get asked in pregnancy, which is what to do with those women who come in with their classic cold sinus symptoms, you know, the runny nose, congestion, sore throat. It seems very simple, but I guess I wanted to get your opinion on, you know, GPs are often unsure about what over-the-counter remedies are safe to recommend.
Yeah, so basically certainly, you know, well, for one thing, we don't recommend using non-steroidals. So the important thing, I suppose, firstly, is to manage fever, because we know that high fever in early pregnancy can be associated with higher rates of miscarriage and other sort of potentially neural tube defects as well. So we're just kind of, you know, that's really, really important. And a lot of women really, you know, have the fear of God put into them around taking anything, so won't even take Panadol. But we certainly are very, very sort of, you know, tell them definitely you should be definitely taking your fever control and not non-steroidals. In terms of over-the-counter, we generally recommend the nighttime preparations are better because they don't contain the sort of more stimulant-y things. So things like antihistamines and sort of using all the nasal sprays. So sprays are better in that also because you get less absorption and, you know, using, you know, sort of Fess and whatever else and the sort of saline and things.
And we're avoiding the oral decongestants.
Look, I think we don't complete, but we just say, look, we generally recommend you use the nighttime ones. The daytime ones you can, but again, not excessively, and there is that small risk because things like the there may be some sort of vasoconstrictive things. But look, in theory, we've got quite a good fact sheet on it. Some other safe, we've got, I think, a cough and cold fact sheet on it, and that sort of goes through stuff as well. But so in general, you know, and certainly if someone's inadvertently used it, we'd be quite, you know, reassuring, but generally minimize those, the daytimey ones.
I do just want to ask you as well your opinion on the risk of cleft palate with ondansetron and how high that risk is.
Look, I think the studies are, you know, the data, again, there's some conflicting data, but overall there's not a significantly increased risk. I suppose when in terms of treating morning sickness and nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, I get a bit upset when women are put on ondansetron almost as first-line treatment because it should not be first-line treatment. So there's a lot of drugs or medications they could try before they end up on ondansetron. From a sort of embryological point of view, the palate's formed by 10, 11 weeks. So basically, if a woman, you know, starts getting morning sickness at 6 to 7 weeks, then, you know, she should have gone through things like doxylamine and B6 and possibly Maxilon, although I don't think Maxilon's a great drug, before she's on ondansetron. So there's a lot of women that are going to get put on ondansetron pretty much first line, and I don't think that's appropriate. And so, you know, by the time you're on it after 9 or 10 weeks, there's not an issue of cleft anyway. It's a, you know, ondansetron works, but it, you know, causes people to be constipated. It's expensive. You know, it's not ideal. And Maxilon, I think, is not a good drug, and it's a particularly not good drug for women who've got a history of anxiety and depression because it certainly can exacerbate those symptoms. So, and the other thing is, because I think GPs and generally people think Maxilon's fine, people are on it for a long time. They shouldn't be technically. And there is a risk of sort of extrapyramidal, you know, symptoms, but also really exacerbating underlying anxiety, depression. So, you know, just to be aware of that.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, to me, it sounds like it's all a bit of a complex area, but in general, the message would be taking, I guess, more of a holistic view of your patient in the context of their pregnancy, but also in the context, I guess, of their own health. And then having that discussion, shared decision-making, and, you know, coming to a plan after that. I guess as GPs, we should just all know and be aware of where we can get our information and resources from to guide these women.
And the really important thing too is just not, I mean, we get people who are told, who've been referred to us to, you know, to discuss termination for absolutely trivial exposures. And it's really hard to come back from that. So, you know, unless you really, you know, Roaccutane, but even then, you know, it's a person's decision. I would never tell someone to terminate. I'd say, well, look, these are the risks. You need to make that decision based on your personal beliefs and, you know, comfort with uncertainty, but really not giving people directive advice and also not giving people wrong advice, because I mean it's very hard to come back from that, and it's important that you make your decision based on the information that is correct, because you know you don't want to be then I suppose you know regretting that decision.
Yeah. No, it's all very helpful information. And, you know, thank you so much, Deborah, for joining us and sharing your expertise today. Congratulations as well, because you mentioned earlier MotherSafe is coming up to 25 years.
Yeah,
so
right.
I thought it's worthwhile just mentioning that because it's a fantastic service and I definitely use it a lot. So, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk us through all of these different considerations today and helping us to, I guess, navigate some of these common challenges that GPs can face.
Pleasure. Yeah. Thank you.
So for everyone tuning in, thank you very much for being with us. We hope this episode has been useful and informative, and I've certainly learned some very valuable insights to take away. Please do keep listening. We'll have several podcasts coming up, particularly on recent clinical updates in women's health. I hope you have enjoyed the podcast today, and I hope you'll be listening again soon. Thanks and goodbye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Checkup by Medcast. If you found today's episode helpful, don't forget to follow, rate, and share it with your colleagues. For more episodes, clinical resources, courses, and upcoming events, head to medcast.com.au.